This audio recording is protected under U.S. copyright laws. It is produced by Nichols Patrick CPE and provided by your State Society of CPAs for your personal non-commercial use. Further reproduction, distribution, or commercial use of this recording without written permission from Nichols Patrick is prohibited. Requests for permission to reproduce this material should be addressed to Nichols Patrick CPE, Suite A, 973 West Liberty Street, Hubbard, Ohio, 44425. Welcome to the weekly tax update for August 19th, 2013. It was an interesting week with a variety of developments, beginning with the IRS publishing its new priority guidance plan 2 months earlier than last year, including and adding to that plan guidance for applying for 501c4 status and guidance for how we're going to all respond to the Supreme Court's invalidation of Section 3 of the Defense of Marriage Act. So we got 501c4 guidance and DOMA guidance coming. Then the Ninth Circuit addresses a very difficult situation, which appears to be conflict in the law regarding the status, the employment status, of an individual who worked for a foreign government. Then a complex estate plan, which had to be changed, involved the transfer of life insurance from one trust to another, and the IRS rules that that was not a transfer for value. Then, proposed regulations on requesting innocent spouse relief, in which the IRS finally brings together some disjointed guidance and acknowledges the validity of the court decision which knocked down their 2-year rule. They still retain the 2-year rule for 6015 B and C, but not for 6015 F. Then, the recurring question of whether a partial tax payment was a deposit or a tax payment, and what we have to do to make sure that it is a tax payment and or a deposit, whichever we want, and why that's important. A S corporation found liable for employment tax deficiency. This, we had one last week, we have another one this week. Then final regulations on information disclosure for insurance affordability programs. This is the information which is permitted to be disclosed by Internal Revenue Code Section 6103L21, and we're going to talk a little bit about that because we now have contractors. Health and Human Services is contracting with individuals who are getting 20 hours of training, and they're going to have access to all of your medical records. Then a classic case of an S corporation, of exactly how an S corporation works in allocating income to its shareholders who are obligated to pick it up whether they actually get the money or not. Consolidated guidance on late S corporation election procedures. Finally, one revenue procedure that deals with late S elections of any kind for any reason, whether it be a Q sub, an ESBIT, the late election itself, or even a late election to be an S corporation if you're organized as a limited liability company. A win for a musician, a win for a taxpayer whose business expense deductions were allowed even though he lost money for 7 years. And finally, a shocker, the IRS announces cuts to refundable corporate AMT credit payments between August 13th and September 30th, the end of the government's fiscal year. The IRS is not going to pay the full amount of claimed refundable corporate AMT payments. They are reducing those payments by 38%. I presume that your AMT credit will still be preserved even though you can't get the money now. So that's what we have ahead of us. Let's get started. The new priority guidance plan adds 501c4 and Defense of Marriage Act guidance. There are 317 projects in the guidance plan. Last year, 3 were closed with no action, and 129 were published. So that, and we have about the same number. So the IRS has disposed of 132 projects, and they've added about the same number. The most important thing for most of us is that the IRS has guidance on a fast track for how we're going to prepare income tax returns for same-sex married couples in states that permit same-sex marriage, and how we're going to prepare income tax returns in states that don't, even though the federal government apparently is going to be required to do so. So you're you want if you want to it, it's it's daunting. It's 34 pages of bureaucratic nonsense as they list all the things they're going to do, but if you're interested in it, you can find it on the IRS website. Next, we have Michael Rosenfeld, a decision of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. This was this tax court decision back in May of 2011 is cited as TC Memo 2011-110, and the tax court did a thorough job, 13-page opinion, of analyzing this issue. Here's the deal. Michael Rosenfeld was independently engaged as a communications consultant in his own business. At some point, he contacted the British General Consulate, and they were looking for someone to help them with their communications. He made a deal to work for them, and they hired him. They gave him a contract as a grade 8 trade consultant, agreeing to pay him so much money a year, and the contract was for a period of years. Mr. Rosenfeld submitted monthly invoices for the amount that he was paid. He had other clients. He had a history of being self-employed, and Code Section 3121B11 says that for purposes of FICA, when you're employed by a foreign government, that is not considered to be employment. So Mr. Rosenfeld, as I probably most of us would have, treated the money that he received from the British Consul General as additional fees, reported it on his Schedule C, paid self-employment tax, but he based his SEP contribution on his self-employment income, including the income from the British Consul General. According to the tax court, and now affirmed by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, Mr. Rosenfeld is liable for excise tax on his excess pension contributions because he was a common law employee while providing services to the foreign government. It didn't matter that the foreign government is not required to withhold payroll taxes. It matters that the law says he met all the qualifications for a common law employee, and the tax court back in 2011 actually went through the list of attributes of an employee relationship. I thought these two paragraphs from the tax court opinion were particularly telling. Here we go. Petitioner has been a sole proprietor for many years and has paid his own federal income and self-employment taxes. In addition to his own understanding of his relationship with the British Consul General, petitioner had the assistance of a tax return preparer who had prepared his tax returns for over 25 years and prepared his 2003 return. Petitioner's tax return preparer also agreed on his understanding of petitioner's employment relationship with the British Consul General that his earnings were reportable on Schedule C. Petitioner, Mr. Rosenfeld, relied in good faith on his tax return preparer. Under petitioner's unique circumstances, the similarity of his consultant work to his work for the British Consul General and the difficulty of the interplay between sections 3121 and 401C, the court finds that it was reasonable for petitioner to rely on the advice of his tax return preparer in determining he was an independent contractor, and that's where the quote ends, and if he was an independent contractor, then he was entitled to report this income on Schedule C, and he was entitled to make a SEP contribution. In effect, the court is saying the law is so complicated, neither the taxpayer nor his return preparer could be expected to understand it. So, the taxpayer is subject to the excise tax for an excess contribution to his SEP, but no way should he be subject to the penalty under Section 6662 for underpayment of his tax or for negligence. Next, we've got Letter Ruling 2013-32-001, a complex ruling, or ruling on a complex set of facts, in which the purchase of a life insurance policy from Trust Number 1 by Trust Number 2, although it is a transfer for value, does not affect the exclusion from income of any proceeds which might be received under the policy, because the purchase will be treated as a transfer to the insured and a partner of the insured, both of which are exceptions to the general rule of Section 101, a summary of the facts. Trust number one was formed, and it held a joint and survivor life insurance policy on the lives of husband and wife. After the trust was created, a daughter was diagnosed with a disability that limited her ability to manage her affairs. Husband is going to establish a second trust, an irrevocable trust, which has the same beneficiaries as the original trust, but it is a perpetual trust with a special needs provision. Husband and wife are separately partners in a real estate partnership. When Trust 1 transfers the policy to Trust 2, that is a transfer for value, but because Trust 2 is the husband's trust, it is a transfer to the same taxpayer. And to the extent the wife has an interest, it is a transfer to the husband's partner, even though the policy is not transferred to the partnership. It's a very interesting ruling, something that we want to tuck away, perhaps these little things that we learn every week that make us better practitioners. Next, proposed regulations published August 13, 2013, providing guidance on the time and manner for requesting relief from joint and several liability under Internal Revenue Code Section 6015 and equitable relief under Section 66. The regulations clarify what constitutes collection activities for purposes of starting the two-year deadline that, by the way, continues to apply to Regulation Section 6015-2 and 6015-3, which address 6015B and C. And by the way, we don't hear a lot about Section 66, but Section 66 deals with claims for equitable relief from the federal income tax liability resulting from the operation of state community property law. The IRS uses the same procedures under Section 66 for determining eligibility for equitable relief under 66C as it does for 6015F. Then one thing to remember taking away from this is that the two-year rule, that you have to appeal within 2 years if you're claiming relief within 2 years of the first collection activity, if you're claiming relief under 6015B or C, but not under 6015F. There you have the three-year statute of limitations. That's probably the most important takeaway from this particular piece of the announcement. Then we have Leon Syring, a decision of the United States District Court for the Western District of Wisconsin. In her capacity as the personal representative of the estate of Marshall Syring, Leon followed the advice of her accountant and paid $170,000 estate tax with a request for extension of for filing the estate tax return. But the accountant had severely overestimated the estate tax liability. It wound up being only $25,000. Unfortunately, they didn't get the return filed on time. It should have been filed January 14, 2007. It wasn't filed until February 19, 2010, because she thought the liability was more than $170,000. Ms. Syring did not designate the amount of her payment with the extension as a deposit. There was no designation, which meant the IRS treated it as a tax payment. They recorded it as a tax payment. And since the estate did not file its return on time, the 3 year statute of limitations is run, and there is no law that permits a recovery of a tax payment that was made more than 3 years before you ask for the payment to be refunded. The lesson here is if you are making a payment in uncertain circumstances, make sure you designate the payment as a deposit, and you do that in writing, and you ask for an acknowledgement from the Internal Revenue Service. Next, another S corporation found liable for employment tax deficiencies because it failed to pay adequate compensation to its sole shareholder. The citation is Sean McAlary, TC Summary Opinion 2013-62. Mr. McAlary was getting tax advice from a Mark Botta, a tax return preparer with offices in Newport Beach, California, and Las Vegas, Nevada. And pursuant to Mr. Botta's advice, Mr. McAlary set up an S corporation with himself as the President, Secretary, Treasurer, sole director, and sole shareholder. In the minutes of organizing this S-corporation, Mr. Botta as the planner and Mr. McAlary attempted to limit Mr. McAlary's annual compensation to $24,000, regardless of the profitability of the S-corporation, and any additional compensation would be based on having additional brokers involved in Mr. McAlary's real estate business. Didn't happen. McAlary was the only broker. He had gross receipts of $376,000 in 2004, $405,000 in 2005, distributed to himself $240,000 in 2007 from gross receipts of $518,000. Now, the issue is joined as to whether $24,000 as wages was an appropriate amount, and the answer is no. The IRS brought on an expert witness who calculated that reasonable compensation for Mr. McAlary would have been $100,755. The judge found that while the testimony of the IRS expert was interesting, it probably was a little excessive, and so the judge settled on reasonable compensation for Mr. McAlary of $83,000. In any event, Mr. McAlary's S-corporation winds up owing additional tax, FICA, FUTA, penalties of just a little more than $16,000. The lesson here is very clear that when the IRS audits your return, and they will, if you're an S-corporation paying token wages, you're going to have a fight on your hands. You're either going to pay additional tax and penalties, or you'll pay lawyer's fees, and you'll still pay additional tax and penalties. No one is winning these reasonable compensation cases with compensation of $24,000 a year. It just isn't happening. Next, we have the final regulations on information disclosure for insurance affordability programs, and this addresses information which will be disclosed to employees or contractors working for Health and Human Services in order to determine the qualification of an individual taxpayer for subsidies under the Affordable Care Act. Now, what makes this frightening is there are contractors around the country who are contracting with Health and Human Services to provide advisors to work with individuals to determine the individual's eligibility for subsidies under the Affordable Care Act. The problem with this is these advisors are being recruited from the ranks of the unemployed. They're getting 20 hours of training, and they're going to be permitted access to extremely sensitive health care information. That's why the IRS rushed these regulations through, in order to lay out exactly what information will be available. There are supposedly safeguards established under Internal Revenue Code Section 6103(p)(4), but all you have to do is pick up the daily newspaper or watch the evening news, and you know what kind of safeguards we have over sensitive information in the hands of the federal government. There are going to be very lightly trained individuals with free access, to a lot of very sensitive information about individual taxpayers. Next, a decision of the tax court, TC Memo 2013-184, Ramesh Kumar. Here, Ramesh Kumar is a doctor. He's a shareholder in an S corporation that's practicing medicine. Got into a dispute with his fellow shareholder, which led ultimately to a negotiated settlement. In the negotiated settlement, Dr. Kumar sold his stock in one corporation to Dr. Woody, and Dr. Woody bought Dr. Kumar's stock. So they basically were involved in two deals. At the end of the day, each doctor owned his own S corporation. The problem here is that while they negotiated the sale of the stock, somebody forgot that there was going to be income reported during the period of the year that Dr. Kumar was in fact a shareholder of what wound up being Dr. Woody's corporation. So Dr. Kumar got a K-1 reporting $250,000 of income for the period that he owned the S Corporation stock, which apparently they had not thought about in negotiating the sale. So he's got $250,000 of income that's going to be taxed at 35%. And all that does is increase his basis in the stock, which is going to benefit him 15%, maybe 20%. Well, no, it's 15% because it's not in 2013. Now, that's a bad trade. And if there was a CPA involved who missed that and therefore gave bad advice, I think you could expect to have a professional liability claim. What's important here is to remember that if your individual owns stock in an S corporation for any period during the year, at when the tax return is prepared, the individual is going to get a K-1 reporting their share of the income. And so your contract for sale of the shares needs to specifically deal with the anticipated outcome. Are you going to get, if you get a K-1 reporting income, is the purchaser going to be required, is the corporation going to be required to actually make a cash distribution of that amount? Or is it, or not? I mean, you can consider it in your settlement, but you certainly need to address it. It should not come as a surprise. Next, Revenue Procedure 2013-30, 17 pages of accumulating in one place all of the guidance on late S-Corporation election procedures. Revenue Procedure 2013-30 is now the sole authority for requesting relief from a late election, a late Q-sub election, an ESBIT election, a QIST election, the 2553, the S election itself, and all of the preceding revenue procedures. Revenue Procedure 2003-43, Revenue Procedure 2007-62, 97-48, 2004-49, 2004-49, all of those revenue procedures are now superseded by Revenue Procedure 2013-30. Next, Thomas Allen Gullion is a saxophone player and has been a saxophone player for a long time. He earned his living as a saxophone player before he started a family and decided he needed something more reliable and became a computer programmer. He has continued, however, to keep his chops, as they say in the music business. He's continued to play and he's continued to try to develop projects, and over 7 years he's not made any money. But in TC Summary Opinion 2013-65, the tax court finds that his musical activities are a trade or business, allowing him to deduct related expenses under Section 162, declining, of course, to impose the accuracy-related penalty that the IRS sought. And this, by the way, was not a slam dunk. Mr. Gullion had claimed losses over 7 years of $130,000, with gross receipts of only $13,000. Now, he finally did show a small profit in 2011, but 2011 was not on the table here. He began performing on the saxophone at the age of 8, played professionally since age 16. In his 2008 return, which is the point at issue here, he filed two Schedules C, one for work as a computer consultant, the other for his business as a musician, the losses from the musician business offsetting the profits from the computer consulting business. The court applied the standard factors: expertise of the taxpayer, time and effort, similar activities, history of income or losses, the financial status of the taxpayer, elements of personal pleasure or recreation, to find that in this particular case, the unique facts augured for treating Mr. Gullion as independently engaged in the trader business of playing the saxophone with an honest intention of making a profit. Finally, and I got to this headline and I couldn't believe it, August 12, 2013, in order to comply with fiscal 2013 budget sequestration cuts, the IRS will reduce payments of the refundable portion of corporate alternative minimum tax credits by 38%. For original and amended returns beginning August 13th and ending September 30th. Truly remarkable. That's it for this week. Remember, stay safe.